He took off his jacket and laid it on the bench beside him. He watched her move lids and pots on the small cook stove. She put a bowl and spoon in front of him. The chili was thick, red like fresh blood, and full of dried corn and fresh venison. She stood by the window and looked outside. "The sky is clear. You can see the stars tonight." She spoke without turning around. He felt a chill bristle across his neck, and it was difficult to swallow the mouthful of stew. He had watched the sky every night, looking for the pattern of stars the old man drew on the ground that night. Late in September, he saw them in the north. He had left Laguna before dawn and drove all day until he came to the big arroyo, where years of summer rain had gradually eroded the clay bank away from the narrow plank bridge, cutting a deep new channel between the road and the bridge. He got up from the table and walked back through the rooms. He pushed the porch screen door wide open and looked up at the sky. Old Batoni's stars were there. So they flew all the way up again. They went to a place in the west. See, these things were complicated. They called outside his house. "You downstairs, how are things?" "Okay," he said. "Come down." They went down inside. "Maybe you want something." "Yes, we need tobacco." Caterpillars spread out dry corn husks on the floor. He rubbed his hands together, and tobacco fell into the corn husks. Then he folded up the husks and gave the tobacco to them. He watched her face, and her eyes never shifted. They were with him while she moved out of her clothes and while she slipped his jeans down his legs, stroking his thighs. She unbuttoned his shirt, and all he was aware of was the heat of his own breathing and the warmth radiating from his belly, pulsing between his legs. He was afraid of being lost, so he repeated trail marks to himself. "This is my mouth tasting the salt of her brown breasts. This is my voice calling out to her." He eased himself deeper within her and felt the warmth close around him like river sand, softly giving way underfoot and closing firmly around the ankle in cloudy warm water. But he didn't get lost, and he smiled at her as she held his hips and pulled him closer. He let the motion carry him, and he could feel the momentum within, at first almost imperceptible, gathering in his belly. When it came, it was the edge of a steep riverbank crumbling under the downpour until suddenly it all broke loose and collapsed into itself. He rearranged the goat hides under the blankets and rolled over on his back. Under his leg, he could feel the damp, wide leaf pattern that had soaked into the blanket where she lay. He dreamed about the cattle that night. It was a continuous dream that wasn't interrupted even when she reached out for him again and pulled him on top of her. He went on dreaming while he moved inside her, and when he heard her whisper, he saw them scatter over the crest of a round, bare hill, running away from him, scattering out around him like ripples in still water. She got up before dawn. When she left, he got dressed and followed her. The air felt damp and cold like the ground after the snow has melted into it, making it dense and rich. He stood on the steps and looked at the morning stars in the west. He breathed deeply, and each breath had a distinct smell of snow from the north, of ponderosa pine on the rimrock above. Finally, he smelled horses from the direction of the corral, and he smiled. Being alive was all right then. He hadn't breathed like that for a long time. He walked to the corral and untied the mare. He led her to the tall grass around the pool and held the reins while she grazed, watching how she took great mouthfuls, working the bit with her tongue so that it didn't interfere with chewing the grass. He squatted down by the pool and watched the dawn spreading across the sky like yellow wings. The mare jingled the steel shanks of the bit with her grazing, and he remembered the sound of the bells in late November, when the air carried the jingling like snowflakes in the wind. Before dawn, southeast of the village, the bells would announce their approach, the sound shimmering across the sandhills, followed by the clacking of turtle-shell rattles, all these sounds gathering with the dawn. Coming closer to the river, faintly at first, faint as the pale yellow light emerging across the southeast horizon, the sounds gathered intensity from the swelling colors of dawn. And at the moment the sun came over the edge of the horizon, they suddenly appeared on the riverbank, the Katsina approaching the river crossing. He stood up. He knew the people had a song for the sunrise. Sunrise, we come at sunrise to greet you. We call you at sunrise. Father of the clouds, you are beautiful at sunrise. Sunrise. He repeated the words as he remembered them, not sure if they were the right ones, but feeling they were right. Feeling the instant of the dawn was an event which, in a single moment, gathered all things together, the last stars, the mountaintops, the clouds, and the winds, celebrating this coming. The power of each day spilled over the hills in great silence. Sunrise. He ended the prayer with sunrise, because he knew the dawn people began and ended all their words with sunrise. The horse had stopped grazing and was standing still. Whether she had eaten all the grass she could reach and was waiting for him to move her, or whether she had paused the way the mule deer stopped grazing at dawn, he didn't know. Maybe the dawn woke the instinct and the dim memory of the blood, when horses had been as wild as the deer, and at sunrise went into the trees and thickets to hide. He tied her in the corral again and walked back to the house. The massive walls had been plastered with red clay mud, but the weather had exposed the straw and the plaster. Under a broken tin rain gutter, plaster was peeling away, exposing brown adobe bricks. He tried to determine when it had been built, but except for the sagging screen all around the long porch, the house was like the mesas around it. Years had little relation to it. Along the south wall, tall orange sunflowers were still blooming among dry corn stalks. The wind of the night before had twisted the sunflowers around the brittle corn stalks, so that in the early morning light, the dried-up corn plants were bearing big orange sunflowers that dusted the hard-packed earth beneath them with orange pollen. Somebody had planted blue morning glories below each of the four wide windows, and the vines of the blue flowers were climbing cotton strings that had been nailed to the window frames. The morning glories were open wide, themselves the color of the sky, with thin white clouds spreading from the center of the blossoms into the bright blue. She fed him cold roast venison and coffee. She sat at the other end of the table examining buckskin bundles and rawhide pouches. Occasionally she laid a round, shiny pebble on the table, and once he saw animal teeth and claws in one bundle she unwrapped. He wanted to ask her what she was doing, but something about the way she ignored his eyes kept him quiet. She worked intently with the rocks. A few were light-colored and appeared to be sandstone, an ochre-yellow sandstone with a powdery fine texture he had never seen before. She unwrapped a pinkish-gray stone from a muslin cloth and laid it on the table beside a powdery blue stone. She rolled the strings that had been wrapped around the muslin bundle into a tight ball and looked at him abruptly. She still said nothing, but worked more slowly now, conscious that he was watching. She reached into a flower sack by her feet and brought out bundles of freshly gathered plants. She sniffed them and blew on them before she matched the plants with the stones, putting a sprig of blue-gray mountain sage with the blue stone. The dark yellow plant from the rocky mesa top smelled like wet tobacco. She laid it beside the ochre sandstone, and then she pulled out a long vine covered with tiny white flowers, with six sharp petals like fallen stars. She shook the vine gently, and small black ants that had been clinging to the leathery green vine fell to the floor, making a circle around her feet until the crumbs around the stove lured them away. Sunshine from the window made a big square on the floor, and something in the silence of the room was warm and comfortable like this sunlight. He finished the coffee in the tin cup and stood up. "Thank you," he said. She looked up from the vine and nodded. The trail was parallel to the top of the orange sandrock mesa. It was almost too narrow for a horse, and the mare sent a stream of pebbles and small rocks rolling down the steep slopes. He leaned forward over her shoulders to make the climb easier. The sun was moving higher into the sky, and the cliffs of the mesa radiated the sun's warmth. He stopped her near the top and tied his jacket behind the saddle, over the bedroll and sack of food. He looked at the sky. It had a bright blue intensity that only autumn and the movement of the sun from its summer place in the sky could give it. He studied the sky all the rest of the way up. The mare had only one direction to go because the trail had become too narrow even for her to turn around. At the top, the wind was cold. He stopped to put on his jacket and rest the mare. Below, the house was hidden by the foothills, but the country beyond it spread out before him in all directions. To the east was the Rio Puerco Valley, where the river had cut a deep, narrow arroyo that now carried the water too low to benefit the valley land. Years of wind and no rain had finally stripped the valley down to dark gray clay, where only the bluish salt bush could grow. Beyond the Rio Puerco, to the southeast, he could see the blue mountains east of the Rio Grande, where the rich valley was full of their cities. But from this place, there was no sign the white people had ever come to this land. They had no existence then, except as he remembered them. So for a while he forgot, and sought out the southern peaks that were thin blue and skeletal in the great distance. The mountain had been named for the swirling veils of clouds, the membranes of foggy mist clinging to the peaks, then leaving them covered with snow. This morning the mountain was dusted with snow, and the blue-gray clouds were unwinding from the peaks. He pulled the mare away from her grazing and remounted. He trotted her west across the grassy flat toward the cerros, gently rounded hills of dark lava rock which were covered with a thin crust of topsoil and grass, edged with thickets of scrub oak. The pine trees grew in groves along the ridges above the dry lakebed flats, but as he rode closer to the mountain, the land descended into a solid pine forest, and the scrub oak and grass grew only in small clearings. The white ranchers called this place North Top, but he remembered it by the story Josiah had told him about a hunter who walked into a grassy meadow up here and found a mountain lion cub chasing butterflies. As long as the hunter sang a song to the cub, it continued to play. But when the hunter thought of the cub's mother and was afraid, the mountain lion cub was startled and ran away. The Laguna people had always hunted up there. They went up the slopes of the cone-shaped peaks in the summer, when the deer were reddish-brown, the hair short and shining while they browsed in meadows above the tree line to avoid the heat. In late fall, as the deer moved down with each snowstorm, the people hunted the foothills and cerros and the grassy dry lake flats of the big plateau. And finally, in the winter, when the deer had heavy dark gray coats and the bitter snow winds drove them down twisting narrow trails, the Laguna hunters found them, fat from acorns and piñones growing in the narrow steep canyons below the rim. All but a small part of the mountain had been taken. The reservation boundary included only a canyon above Encinal, and a few miles of timber on the plateau. The rest of the land was taken by the National Forest and by the state, which later sold it to white ranchers who came from Texas in the early 1900s. In the 20s and 30s, the loggers had come, and they stripped the canyons below the rim and cut great clearings on the plateau slopes. The logging companies hired full-time hunters who fed entire logging camps, taking 10 or 15 deer each week, and 50 wild turkeys in 1 month. The loggers shot the bears and mountain lions for sport. It was then that the Laguna people understood that the land had been taken, because they couldn't stop these white people from coming to destroy the animals and the land. It was then, too, that the holy men at Laguna and Acoma warned the people that the balance of the world had been disturbed, and the people could expect droughts and harder days to come. White ranchers pastured cattle there, especially during the dry years when no grass grew below the mountain. They fattened them on the plateau during the summer and brought them down to the byres in late fall. Taya rode past white-faced Herefords standing around a windmill. They stared at him and the horse stupidly. He didn't expect to find Josiah's cattle near Herefords because the spotted cattle were so rangy and wild. But without Batoni, he wouldn't have hoped to find the cattle at all. Until the previous night, old Batoni's vision of stars, cattle, a woman, and a mountain had seemed remote. He had been wary, especially after he found the stars, and they were in the north. It seemed more likely to find the spotted cattle in the south, far, far in the south, the direction they had always gone. The last time Josiah had seen them, the cattle had been wandering southwest along the boundary between the reservation and state land. Mateo told Robert he was going north, up into the mountains, to look for the cattle. Robert shrugged his shoulders and shook his head. "Maybe," he said. "Maybe. I guess once somebody got 'em, they could have taken them just about anywhere." So he had gone, not expecting to find anything more than the winter constellation in the north sky overhead. But suddenly, Batoni's vision was a story he could feel happening. From the stars and the woman, the mountain and the cattle would come. Teo stopped the mare by a pine tree on a ridge near a scrub oak thicket. He tied the lariat rope around her neck and slipped off the bridle to let her graze. He untied the food sack from behind the saddle and walked over to the tree. Layers of reddish-brown pine needles sank softly under his feet, and he brushed aside the pine cones before he sat down. From where he sat, the world looked as if it were more than half-blue sky closing around like a dome. The sun was leaning into the southwest sky. He chewed the jerky as carefully as the mare chewed the grass, pushing against cords of gristle with his tongue, feeling the slippery fibers give way between his teeth. He swallowed the last piece of jerky and felt it roll with urgency and excitement in his belly. The Texans who bought the land fenced it and posted signs in English and Spanish warning trespassers to keep out. But the people from the land grants and the people from Laguna and Acoma ignored the signs and hunted deer. Occasionally, the Mexicans took a cow. So later on, the ranchers hired men to patrol on horseback, carrying 30-30s and saddle scabbards. But the armed riders made little difference, because they were miles and miles of fence, and two or three hunters could easily slip between them. Still, he would have to be careful. When he located the cattle, he would drive them back. He had the bill of sale from Ulibarri buttoned in his shirt pocket, just in case. He got up feeling happy and excited. He would take the cattle home again, and they would follow the plans Josiah had made and raise a new breed of cattle that could live in spite of drought and hard weather. He tied the lunch sack under the bedroll and pulled the bridle back over the mare's ears. He rode west along the south rim of the plateau, watching for sudden movements that were speckled white. The barbed wire fence paralleled the rim, and he could see bits of belly hair the deer left on the barbed wire where their trails crossed the fence. Fences had never stopped the speckled cattle either, but there was no sign they had been there. So he rode north, looking for another fence that might be holding them. He rode miles across dry lake flats and over rocky cerros until he came to a high fence of heavy-gauge steel mesh with three strands of barbed wire across the top. It was a fence that could hold the spotted cattle. The white man, Floyd Lee, called it a wolf-proof fence, but he had poisoned and shot all the wolves in the hills, and the people knew what the fence was for. $1,000 a mile to keep Indians and Mexicans out. $1,000 a mile to lock the mountain in steel wire, to make the land his. He was examining the fence and the way the wire was buried underground so animals couldn't crawl or dig under it, when from the corner of his eye he saw something move. They were too far away for him to see the brands, and the light brown spots were difficult to make out on their light hides, but they moved like deer on long, thin legs. It was them. They were strung out on the south slope of a round lava rock hill, moving west along the fence line. He watched them disappear over a ridge, and in a few minutes he saw the lead cow reappear on the far slope, still following the fence line. They had worn a path into the ground along the south boundary fence, walking relentlessly back and forth from east to west, as if waiting for some chance to escape, for some big pine to blow down in the wind and tear open a gate to the south. South. The direction was lodged deep in their bones. He moved quickly. His hands were shaking. The mare snorted and shied away from the sudden motions. He held the reins tight and moved closer to her, slowly, speaking softly. He patted her neck until she was calm again. He looked at the hill where the cattle had disappeared and fumbled, untying the saddle strings. He pulled the bedroll loose and reached into the folds of the blankets. Next to a rope, the most important tool a rider carried was a pair of fencing pliers. Hundreds of miles of barbed wire fence marked boundaries and kept the cattle and horses from wandering. Josiah taught him to watch for loose strands of wire and breaks in the fence. He taught Teo how to mend them before any livestock strayed off reservation land. He helped Teo stitch a leather holster for the pliers one evening after supper, and he reminded him that you never knew when you might be traveling someplace and a fence might get in your way. Josiah had nodded toward Mount Taylor when he said it. He pulled on his work gloves and he cut through four strands of heavy steel wire before he realized he was standing where anyone might see him. He looked around quickly for a fence rider on horseback or a patrol in a pickup truck. His heart was pounding, and he remembered the hide-and-go-seek games of a long time ago, when he had lain flat on the ground trying hard not to pee in his pants. He threw down the pliers and pulled off the gloves. He could think more clearly after he pissed. There was no reason to hurry. The cattle would be easy to find because they stayed close to the south boundary fence. In a few hours it would be dark, and he could go after them. It would be simple. There was no reason to hurry or make foolish mistakes. He tied the mare in a clearing surrounded by a thicket of scrub oak. He sat under a scrub oak and picked up acorns from the ground around him. The oak leaves were already fading from dark green to light yellow, and within the week they would turn gold and bright red. The acorns were losing their green color, too, and the hulls were beginning to dry out. By the time the leaves fell and the acorns dropped, he would be home with the cattle. The sun was hanging low in the branches of the pines at the top of the ridge. The thicket and clearing were in deep shadow. The wind rustled the oak leaves, and the mare's shit sent steam into the cold air. He crouched down with his hands in his pockets and the collar of his jacket pulled up to his ears. Up here, winter was already close. He ate another piece of jerky and a handful of parched corn, waiting for the dark. He swallowed water from the canteen and watched the sky for the autumn evening stars to appear. He fed the mare a handful of parched corn and lifted her unshod hooves to check for damage from the sharp lava rock. He didn't know how well she could run at night over this rocky, unfamiliar country. The dry lake flats and scrub oak ridges could be confusing. The rolling hills scattered with lava rock and the pine ridges between clearings were almost indistinguishable from one another. He'd been fooled by them before when he had gone hunting with Rocky and Robert and Josiah. They had left the truck parked in plain view at the edge of a pine ridge, but at the end of the day, when he and Rocky had started walking back, they expected to see the old green truck parked on every ridge that came into sight. They weren't lost because they knew where they were, but the green truck was lost. They kept hiking across dry lake flats and over oak and pine-covered ridges, saying to each other, "This time, this'll be the place." Until finally Josiah and Robert came bouncing over the rocky flats in the green truck and picked them up. Teo rode the mare slowly along the fence, looking for a place that could be easily located, even at night. He would have only one chance to drive the cattle through the hole in the fence, and while he searched desperately for the opening, they could scatter in every direction. He stopped by a dead pine. Lightning had split it down the middle, and around the charred core, where the bark had peeled away, the tree had weathered silver. Behind it, there was an outcrop of lava that made a knob on top of the ridge. He dismounted and went to work on the wire. The strands of wire were 4 inches apart and a quarter of an inch thick. He had to stop to shake the muscle cramps from his hands. The moon was rising early. He worked on his knees, cutting away the wire at ground level, where it continued under the surface 6 inches deep to discourage coyotes and wolves from digging under it. He tried to clear a place to kneel, but the ground was almost solid with pebbles and rocks. After the first 10 feet of cutting and bending back the wire, his knees went numb. He felt cold air on his skin and knew that his Levi's were worn through at both knees. He was thinking about the cattle and how they had ended up on Floyd Lee's land. If he had seen the cattle on Land-Grant land or in some Acoma's corral, he wouldn't have hesitated to say stolen. But something inside him made him hesitate to say it now that the cattle were on a white man's ranch. He had a crazy desire to believe that there had been some mistake, that Floyd Lee had gotten them innocently, maybe buying them from the real thieves. Why did he hesitate to accuse a white man of stealing, but not a Mexican or an Indian? He took off his gloves and stuck his hands inside his jacket to wipe the broken blisters on his shirt. Sweat made the raw skin sting all the way up both arms, leaving his shoulders with a dull ache. He knew then he had learned the lie by heart, the lie which they had wanted him to learn. Only brown-skinned people were thieves. White people didn't steal because they always had the money to buy whatever they wanted. The lie. He cut into the wire as if cutting away at the lie inside himself. The liars had fooled everyone, white people and Indians alike. As long as people believed the lies, they would never be able to see what had been done to them or what they were doing to each other. He wiped the sweat off his face under the sleeve of his jacket. He stood back and looked at the gaping cut in the wire. If the white people never looked beyond the lie to see that theirs was a nation built on stolen land, then they would never be able to understand how they had been used by the witchery. They would never know that they were still being manipulated by those who knew how to stir the ingredients together. White thievery and injustice boiling up the anger and hatred that would finally destroy the world. The starving against the fat. The colored against the white. The destroyers had only to set it into motion and sit back to count the casualties. But it was more than a body count. The lies devoured white hearts. And for more than 200 years, white people had worked to fill their emptiness. They tried to glut the hollowness with patriotic wars and with great technology and the wealth it brought. And always they had been fooling themselves, and they knew it. The cut in the fence was a good 20 feet wide, large enough for the cattle to find. He walked back to the horse and put away the pliers. He poured water over the raw skin on his hands and drank what was left in the canteen. He pissed one more time. The moon was bright, and the rolling hills and dry lake flats reflected a silvery light illusion that everything was as visible as if seen in broad daylight. But the mare stumbled and threw him hard against the saddle horn, and he realized how deceptive the moonlight was. Exposed root tips and dark rocks waited in deep shadows cast by the moon. Their lies would destroy this world. The trail was splashed with cow manure, and he reined the mare in frequently to lean down from the saddle to see how fresh it was. The farther west the trail went, the higher it was. The pines were tall and thick, and brushy pinon and cedar filled the spaces between the big trees, blocking out nearly all the light. He walked the mare, letting her find a way along the trail where trees and brush had closed in on both sides. He kept his head low and his eyes closed for protection against the pine needles and sharp branches. He stopped on the edge of the clearing. The air was much colder. He had been so intent on finding the cattle that he had forgotten all the events of the past days and past years. Hunting the cattle was good for that. Old Batoni was right. It was a cure for that, and maybe for other things, too. The spotted cattle wouldn't be lost anymore, scattered through his dreams, driven by his hesitation to admit they had been stolen, that the land, all of it, had been stolen from them. The anticipation of what he might find was strung tight in his belly. Suddenly the tension snapped and hurled him into the empty room where the ticking of the clock behind the curtains had ceased. He stopped the mare. The silence was inside, in his belly. There was no longer any hurry. The ride into the mountain had branched into all directions of time. He knew then why the old-timers could only speak of yesterday and tomorrow in terms of the present moment, the only certainty. And this present sense of being was qualified with bare hints of yesterday or tomorrow by saying, I go up to the mountain yesterday, or I go up to the mountain tomorrow. The Kokoyo Kaupata somewhere is stacking his gambling sticks and waiting for a visitor. Rocky and I are walking across the ridge in the moonlight. Josiah and Robert are waiting for us. This night is a single night, and there has never been any other. In the clearing, he expected to see them, some standing, others lying down, the color of their hides reflecting the moon like snow on the mountain peaks. But he found nothing, and at the seventh or eighth clearing, he stopped to listen for them. There was only the rattle of the bit as the mare chewed the grass she had sneaked when they stopped. He jerked her head up from the grass to rid her of any ideas she might have about grazing. His anger excluded everything but the horse. If he didn't break her of the habit right now, she would try to get away with it all the time. He remembered the old black gelding. As long as Josiah had been there watching, the old black horse loped slowly around the big corral. It stood patiently while Rocky slid down its shoulder and then boosted Teo up. But after Josiah went inside the shed to repair bridles, the old horse began to test them. It no longer loped, it trotted. Teo's teeth rattled together, and he had to grip the wiry mane with both hands. His bottom hurt from bouncing against the sharp backbone, and when it felt the loose reins, the black gelding stopped trotting and walked over to the tender green tumbleweed shoots that grew along the fence. Rocky ran over and handed the reins back up to him, and he yelled at the old horse and kicked both heels into its ribs. It raised its head and seemed surprised for a moment, but Teo wasn't strong enough to pull the big head around or keep it away from the weeds, and the gelding went back to nibbling weeds again, acting as if the two little boys weren't there. They didn't want Josiah to know that the old horse had won, because Josiah always said that if they couldn't make the horse behave, then they had no business riding it. So they pretended they were tired of riding and let the old horse loose. As it lumbered out of the corral toward the river, they pelted it with rocks and sticks, and Rocky yelled at it. Josiah came out of the shed to see what all the noise was about. He scolded them for throwing rocks at the old horse, but he had a hard time to keep from smiling. So that old horse won, huh? He said, almost laughing. Even got you throwing rocks and yelling at him. He reined the mare in tight and kept his heels hard against her sides to let her know he meant business. Josiah had always shown them how ridiculous violence and anger were. Beating the mare wouldn't make the spotted cattle appear. He stopped at a wide, shallow stream and dismounted while the mare drank. She had traveled for hours without water. Now she swelled out her sides, drinking. She let out a deep sigh when she was finished and shook herself. She was tired. As he led her away from the stream, he felt the muscles in his thighs get shivery, and his knees were tight and sore from hours in the saddle and from kneeling on the rocks to cut the wire. His hands hurt, and his fingers were still swollen with blisters from the pliers. He knew what was happening. In the sky above the clearing, Orion had fallen over the south edge. He was running out of night. His stomach tensed up again. Whatever night this was, he still had a big hole cut in their fence, and he had to find the cattle and get them out before the fence riders found the break. They would be after him then, tracking him, hunting him down as they had hunted the last few bears on the mountain. His chest was aching with anger. Whatever made him think he could do this? The woman under the apricot tree meant nothing at all. It was all in his own head. When they caught him, they'd send him back to the crazy house for sure. He was trapped now, tricked into trying something that could never work. He still had time to get back. He could pull the sections of wire together and twist the strands into place, and then ride like hell off the mountain. They'd never know who did it. They'd blame Mexicans or Marquez. It would be the smartest thing he could do. All the rest, old Batoni and his stargazing, the woman in her storm-patterned blanket, all that was crazy. The kind of old-time superstition the teachers at Indian school used to warn him and Rocky about. Like the first time in science class, when the teacher brought in a tub full of dead frogs bloated with formaldehyde, and the Navajos all left the room. The teacher said those old beliefs were stupid. The Jemez girl raised her hand and said the people always told the kids not to kill frogs because the frogs would get angry and send so much rain that there would be floods. The science teacher laughed loudly for a long time. He even had to wipe tears from his eyes. "Look at these frogs," he said, pointing at the discolored, rubbery bodies and clouded eyes. "Do you think they could do anything? Where are all the floods? We dissect them in this class every year." As the army doctor had told him, it was all superstition. Seeing Josiah when they shot those goddamn Japs, it was all superstition, believing that the rain had stopped coming because he had cursed it. A strange paralysis accompanied his thoughts. A sudden overwhelming fatigue took hold, and his heart pounded furiously, and he panted, trying to walk only a few feet from the place he had tied the mare. His knees buckled, and he fell into the old pine needles and cones under a tree. This was the end. He wouldn't even be able to try to escape. They would find him collapsed under the tree. His face was in the pine needles where he could smell all the tree, from roots deep in the damp earth to the moonlight blue branches, the highest tips swaying in the wind. The odors wrapped around him in a thin, clear layer that sucked away the substance of his muscle and bone. His body became insubstantial, so that even if the fence riders came looking for him with their 30-30s loaded and cocked, they would see him only as a shadow under the tree. The mountain lion came out from a grove of oak trees in the middle of the clearing. He didn't walk or leap or run. His motions were like the shimmering of tall grass in the wind. He came across the meadow, moving into the wind. Teo watched it with his head against the ground, conscious of pine needles tangled in his hair. He waited for the mare to shy away from the yellow form that moved toward them, but the horse was upwind and didn't stir. The eyes caught twin reflections of the moon. The glittering yellow light penetrated his chest, and he inhaled suddenly. Relentless motion was the lion's greatest beauty, moving like mountain clouds with the wind, changing substance and color in rhythm with the contours of the mountain peaks, dark as lava rock, and suddenly as bright as a field of snow. When the mountain lion stopped in front of him, it wasn't hesitation, but a chance for the moonlight to catch up with him. Teo got to his knees slowly and held out his hand. "Mountain lion," he whispered. "Mountain lion, becoming what you are with each breath, your substance changing with the earth and the sky." The mountain lion blinked his eyes. There was no fear. He gazed at him for another instant and then sniffed the southeast wind before he crossed the stream and disappeared into the trees, his outline lingering like yellow smoke, then suddenly gone. The horse was stamping her front feet and blowing her nostrils open wide to catch the mountain lion smell that was on the wind now. Teo stroked her neck and made sure the rope was tied securely to the tree. He went into the clearing where the mountain lion had stood. He knelt and touched the footprints, tracing his finger around the delicate edges of dust the paw prints had made. Deep, round imprints, each toe a distinctive swirl. He kept his back to the wind and poured yellow pollen from Josiah's tobacco sack into the cup of his hand. He leaned close to the earth and sprinkled pinches of yellow pollen into the four footprints. Mountain lion, the hunter. Mountain lion, the hunter's helper. He rode the mare west again in the direction the mountain lion had come from. The sound of the wind in the pine branches and the smell of snow from the mountain made him alert. At dawn, he stopped on a grassy ridge to watch the sunrise. He let the mare graze, part of the cycle of restoration. Inside him, the muddy water turmoil was settling to the bottom, and streaks of clarity were slowly emerging. Gathering the spotted cattle was only one color of sand falling from the fingertips. The design was still growing, but already long ago it had encircled him. When he turned away from the sun to mount the mare, he saw the spotted cattle grazing in a dry lake flat below the ridge. They were facing southeast, grazing in a herd. They had smelled the horse and the rider and were looking up at the ridge. His motion sent them running, with grass still hanging from wet lips. They ran as Robert said they did, wilder than antelope, smarter than elk about human beings. Their memory of people endured long after all other traces of domestication were gone. And he was counting on another instinct, the dim memory of direction which lured them always south, to the Mexican desert where they were born. They ran southeast in the direction he wanted them to go, with tails straight out behind their manure-stained haunches, running more like deer than cattle, moving from thicket to thicket for cover, avoiding the clearings. They favored trails too low and brushy for horses and riders. He let the mare run far behind them, confident of their direction. The cold air whipped tears in his eyes, but he felt good. They were gathered before him, headed for home. They took the trail they had worn along the fence and followed it east. He watched to be sure none of them circled back, but the old direction was persistent, even in the half-grown calves. He slowed the mare to a lope and let the cattle go. The horse was tiring. She had frothy sweat on her shoulders and neck. If he followed the cattle too closely or pushed them too fast, they might break and scatter. They might miss the opening in the fence. He watched them appear briefly, crossing a ridge about a half mile ahead. They had already slowed from a dead run to a trot. The sky was washed pale blue by the glare of the sun. There were no clouds, but he could feel a strong wind from the west at his back, and he knew there would be storm clouds before noon. In the distance, up ahead, he occasionally caught glimpses of the cattle, trotting steadily. They appeared in clearings and disappeared into oak thickets again, still following the south boundary fence to the east. The tension in the muscles of his neck and shoulders unwound with each breath he took. He smiled and patted the mare on the neck. The hair was still damp and stiff with sweat. He slowed her to a walk, confident that the cattle would veer through the break in the fence and continue south down the trail off the mountain plateau. He kicked his boots loose from the stirrups and stretched his legs. The tendons and muscles unlocked from the flexed position of the saddle. He had proved something to himself. It wasn't as strong as it had once been. It was changing, unraveling like the yarn of a dark, heavy blanket wrapped around a corpse, the dusty, rotted strands of darkness unwinding, giving way to the air. Its smothering pressure was lifting from the bones of his skull. From the corner of his eye, he saw them, at first mistaking them for a strand of his own hair caught by the wind. But when he turned, there were two riders approaching from the north. He whipped the mare into a dead run, crouching low over her neck, trying to guide her over the rocky, uneven terrain down the steep slope of a ridge. They were about a mile away when he first saw them, so he would try to find a deep grove of pine where he could stay until they passed. He strained to see if the cattle were still in sight, wondering if the riders had seen them. The bill of sale in his shirt pocket would mean very little to armed patrolmen chasing a trespasser. He pressed his heels into the mare's sides to make her run faster, but the lava rock was already scattering from under her feet, and she was fighting to keep her balance. He looked over to see if they were on the hilltop behind him yet. They weren't, so he reined the mare in to save some of her strength. He wiped the tears that the wind whipped in his eyes onto the sleeve of his jacket and tried to focus on the ridges and flats ahead, searching for the lava rock knob and the lightning-struck pine that marked the hole in the fence. He opened his eyes to a bright blue sky and clouds that were full but very high. And for an instant he was waking up years before, on a nameless island in the Pacific. He thought he had been hit, and he began to call for Rocky to help. Then he saw the color of his sleeve of his shirt, and he felt the dry lava pebbles pressing into his raw hands. He could remember seeing the sunny bright day and the faint autumn colors emerging in the scrub oak. He remembered thinking how funny it was to be in such trouble in the middle of the day, when it was nighttime and darkness that were suspected occasions of danger. He remembered seeing the skeleton pine tree in the distance, above a bowl-shaped dry lake bed, and the last cow bolting through the opening in the wire, kicking her heels at the wire as she plunged through, disappearing over the horizon. He remembered all this clearly, even the way the mare fell, her front legs sliding in the rocks, and the slow, shivering roll of her body as she fell. The smell of mountain sage surrounded him, and he realized he had skidded through a sage bush. Twigs of sage and oak leaves were caught in his hair and crumbled down the back of his neck. When he tried to move, the inside of his head pounded, so he lay flat and spat out the gritty mountain clay. His ribs hurt when he breathed, but he could move his fingers and lift both legs. He closed his eyes, telling himself that he could afford to rest a while longer, lying to himself the way he had on cold winter mornings when the room was still dark and there was no fire in the stove. "Where were you going so goddamn fast?" The voice was hostile, and it had a drawling Texan sound. He raised himself up on one hand and looked at them. They were both tall and lanky, with light brown hair, and except for their faces, they were the same. Boots scuffed and dusty, jeans faded to the same shade of blue, even their shirt sleeves were rolled to the elbow in the same manner. But the one with the narrow face was agitated and angry. He kept demanding to know what Teo was doing there. "Poaching deer," he said, stepping so close to Teo's hand that he could feel weeds crushed by the boot pressing against his fingers, and for an instant he thought he might step on his hand to make him talk. "Maybe you were rustling yourself a little beef, huh?" He would let them believe anything they wanted. The other man had a small round face and no chin, and his eyes were calm. "Are you hurt?" he said. "Can you stand up?" He put his hand on Teo's left arm and squatted down beside him to get a better grip. Teo kept thinking about the cattle and the gaping hole in the fence, but they didn't act as if they had noticed anything except him. Behind the drumming pain inside his head, he had one thought: to keep them occupied with him, to keep them away from the next ridge. "You better go back for the truck," the cowboy with the round face said. "I think he might be hurt." "Shit! There's nothing wrong with the son of a bitch. Let him ride behind a saddle with me." As they pulled him to his feet, his vision spun away, pulling his head into a shower of bright lights. He stumbled against the big palomino. It snorted and shied away. "Whoa, you jackass! Whoa!" They boosted him up behind the creamy-colored tooled leather saddle. His ears buzzed, and he had to grip the saddle strings tightly to stay erect. The horse sidestepped nervously, feeling the awkward load shifting from side to side on its back. Just as the Texan swung his long, thin leg over the saddle, Teo leaned over and vomited all over the sagebrush. The pain swelled out of his head, pounding through his ears until it hit his belly, and waves of nausea surged up. The sun was going down, and the round-faced man was hunched over on a boulder with his back to the cold wind. He had his hands in his pockets and was chewing tobacco, working his jaws furiously and spitting savagely, sending the brown juice all over the ground around his feet. He saw that Teo was awake, but he didn't speak. The skin on the cowboy's face was wrinkled. It had been rubbed dry and red by the wind and sun. Under the blue bandana he wore around his throat, the skin was still milky and tender. He wasn't much older than Teo. Maybe they both had been in the war together. He acted as if he wanted to forget the whole thing and let the Indian go, But the Texan had gone back for the truck. He wanted to take the Indian back. Maybe because their boss expected them to do something once in a while, shoot a coyote or catch a Mexican. But it was getting late, and the wind was bitter with the snowstorm that had masked the peaks. It would be dark by the time they got him back to the ranch headquarters, and then they would have to drive him all the way to the jail in Grants. It was a lot of trouble just for an Indian. Maybe it would be too much trouble, and they would let him go. Black pebbles and the ancient gray cinders the mountain had thrown poked into his backbone. He closed his eyes but didn't sleep. He felt cold gusts of wind scattering dry oak leaves in the grass. He listened to the cowboy collect tobacco juice in his mouth and the squirting liquid sound when he spat. He was aware of the center beneath him. It soaked into his body from the ground through the torn skin on his hands covered with powdery black dirt. The magnetism of the center spread over him smoothly like rainwater down his neck and shoulders. The vacant, cool sensation glided over the pain like feather-down wings. It was pulling him back, close to the earth, where the core was cool and silent as mountain stone. And even with the noise and pain in his head, he knew how it would be. A returning, rather than a separation. He was relieved because he feared leaving people he loved. But lying above the center that pulled him down closer felt more familiar to him than any embrace he could remember. And he was sinking into the elemental arms of mountain silence. Only his skull resisted, and the resistance increased the pain to a shrill whine. He visualized each piece of his own skull, fingering each curve, each hollow, testing its thickness for a final thin membrane worn thin by time and the witchery of dead ash and mushroomed bullets. He searched thin walls, weak sutures of spindle bones above the ear, for thresholds. He knew if he left his skull unguarded, if he let himself sleep, it would happen. The resistance would leak out and take with it all barriers, all boundaries. He would seep into the earth and rest with the center, where the voice of the silence was familiar, and the density of the dark earth loved him. He could secure the thresholds with molten pain and remain, or he could let go and flow back. It was up to him. He heard the truck motor stop and doors slam. The voices were muffled by the distance, but the Texan hadn't come back alone.
"Hey, I found something. Remember those lion tracks we found last spring? Well, there's fresh ones all over the place, around number 12 windmill. Big son of a bitch. Tracks the size of my palm."
The new voice was high-pitched with excitement. The cowboy got up from the boulder stiffly and spat out the last of the tobacco wad.
"Well, what about this guy?" he said. "I thought you wanted to take him in."
The Texan cleared his throat.
"Shit," he said. "Greasers and Indians, we can run them down any time. But it's been a couple of years since anybody up here got a mountain lion."
"Okay, okay, you were the one that wanted to mess with him, not me."
"Shit. By the time we got him back, the lion'd be long gone."
"Just leave him where he is and let's go get the lion hounds before it gets dark."
"Yeah, we taught him a lesson," the Texan said, his voice fading in and out with the wind. "These goddamn Indians gotta learn whose property this is."
When he woke up again, they were gone, and the wind had calmed down, but the air was heavy and damp. The sky was full of storm clouds. The pain and the pounding inside his head were gone, but when he sat up, he had to move slowly to avoid jarring the soreness inside his skull. His feet and hands were numb from the cold, and his legs were stiff from lying still so long. He sat rubbing his legs and feet with a cold breeze at his back. If he went a few yards over the top of the ridge, he would be in the scrub oaks, out of the storm. The oaks grew thick and close to the ground. He knelt at the edge of the thicket, looking until he found a narrow, winding trail through the fringes of oak.
The deer made trails through every thicket, and some of the big thickets had two or three trails running parallel to the top of the ridge. They moved into the thickets after sunrise and spent their days in the thickets, sleeping and feeding on acorns, crossing a clearing only to reach another stand of scrub oak. The leaves accumulated in deep layers of years, and his feet sank under the new copper leaves that had already fallen this year. The deer made beds in shallow niches deep within the thickets where the oaks grew tall and made canopies of limbs and branches. He lay in a shallow depression and heaped piles of dry leaves over himself until he felt warm again. He looked up through the branches and the leaves, which were yellow and soft, ready to fall. The sky was heavy and dark, and purple veins striated the gray, swollen clouds, dragging their bellies full of snow over the mountaintop. The smell of snow had a cold, damp edge, and a clarity that summer rain never had. The scent touched him deep behind his belly, and he could feel the old anticipation stirring as it had when he was a child, waiting for the first snowflakes to fall. He lay there and hated them. Not for what they wanted to do with him, but for what they did to the earth with their machines, and to the animals with their packs of dogs and their guns. It happened again and again, and the people had to watch, unable to save or to protect any of the things that were so important to them. He ground his teeth together. There must be something he could do to still the vague, constant fear unraveling inside him. The earth and animals might not know. They might not understand that he wasn't one of them. He wasn't one of the destroyers. He wanted to kick the soft white bodies into the Atlantic Ocean. He wanted to scream to all of them that they were trespassers and thieves. He wanted to follow them as they hunted the mountain lion, to shoot them and their howling dogs with their own guns. The destroyers had sent them to ruin this world, and day by day they were doing it. He wanted to scream at Indians like Harley and Helen Jean and Emo that the white things they admired and desired so much, the bright city lights and loud music, the soft, sweet food and the cars, all these things had been stolen, torn out of Indian land. Raw living materials for their cocoyo manipulation. The people had been taught to despise themselves, because they were left with barren land and dry rivers, but they were wrong. It was the white people who had nothing. It was the white people who were suffering as thieves do, never able to forget that their pride was wrapped in something stolen, something that had never been and could never be theirs. The destroyers had tricked the white people as completely as they had fooled the Indians. And now, only a few people understood how the filthy deception worked. Only a few people knew that the lie was destroying the white people faster than it was destroying the Indian people. But the effects were hidden, evident only in the sterility of their art, which continued to feed off the vitality of other cultures, and in the dissolution of their consciousness into dead objects. The plastic and neon, the concrete and steel, hollow and lifeless as a witchery clay figure. And what little still remained to white people was shriveled like a seed hoarded too long, shrunken past its time, and split open now to expose a fragile, pale leaf stem, perfectly formed and dead. It was still dark when he woke up, and he could feel flakes of snow blowing in the wind. He couldn't see if the sky in the east was getting light yet, because the storm clouds were still dense and low. He shook the snow off his hair. The oak leaves had held a shell of snow around him. He stood up and brushed the leaf dust away and pissed a yellow steaming slash through the snow. He walked southeast. He went slowly because his whole body was sore, and because the snow was rapidly covering the ground, even the big rocks, making it difficult to follow the trail even as the darkness dissolved into gray light. The sky was dense and gray. It was difficult to estimate distances. He turned and looked back in the direction of the mountain, but it was hidden in a swirling mass of wet clouds. He ate a handful of snow,
blinking the flakes off his eyelashes as he tried to face the direction the storm was coming from, because the cowboys had gone that way. A gust of wind brought the center of the storm down, and the big flakes fluttered around his head like summer moths crowding the sky, rising high over the edges of wet black lava and the tips of yellow grass. The snow was covering everything, burying the mountain lion's tracks and obliterating his scent. The white men and their lion hounds could never track the lion now. He walked with the wind at his back. It would cover all signs of the cattle, too. The wet flakes would cling to the fence wire and freeze into a white crust. The wire he had cut away and the gaping hole in the fence would be lost in the whiteout, hidden in snow on snow. Under his feet, the dark mountain clay was saturated, making it slippery and soft. The ranch roads would be impassable with sticky mud,